The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Steve Schooner. Steve is the Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. Steve, that's a mouthful, Steve. I practiced, and I still screwed it up the first time.
The one thing that you learn in Management 101 is the shorter the title, the more important. There's only one president, but I have 85 words in my title. Right. You conclude whatever you want from that.
Okay.
Great to be back.
I'm glad you said that, not me.
Great to be back on the show, Roger.
Right. So we're going to talk about... first of all, it's always great to have you on the show. And I have to tell you, I get more feedback from your appearances and the thought-provoking stuff.
I hope at least some of it's positive.
Yeah, some of it. But it's by and large positive. At least that's what I tell you to keep you coming back. First, the interesting topics, and I guess we're sort of getting to the end of his tenure, you would assume. There is an election coming up. But Frank Kendall and the Better Buying Power Principles, he put out earlier this year a
terrific document,
a memo or just an article, a piece about it. It is a very good article, and I've shared it with people across the community, and we're going to slice and dice this time.
Let's just take a minute to set the stage. Remember that Better Buying Power arguably started with Ash Carter in the job.
Yep.
Now, I think most of us think that it has become more sophisticated, more nuanced, frankly, more reasonable since Frank took it over with Better Buying Power iterations 2.0 and now 3.0. But the great document that you were mentioning that Frank put out in an article early in this calendar year is a short piece called Better Buying Power Principles. What are they? And I mean, the great thing is Frank starts from the premise that people are consistently telling him that they're making decisions based on better buying power principles. And he thought that was pretty funny because they'd never published any.
Right. I guess that's how you suck up to the boss, right?
Exactly. So he figures, what the heck? And so apparently he was with a group of sophisticated senior people. So they sat down and they tried to bang something out. And they came up with what they called principles suggested by acquisition experts, or what are the better buying power principles. Now, there's 10 of them, and we could go through them 1 through 10, but let's not necessarily take them in order. But there are so many good ones in here. And frankly, compared to all of the stuff that you've heard from Better Buying Power, the really convoluted PowerPoint chart that's now impossible to follow, I mean, this is really valuable, thematic, thought-provoking stuff, and I think it's worth talking about.
Absolutely.
All right, so just for fun, let's start with principle number 5.
Okay.
Nice and easy. Principle number 5. People matter most. We can never be too professional or too competent. All right. Look, if you've played in this business for a long time, you know that statutes can't improve the procurement process, regulations can't, and even policy guidance can't. You can write a Mythbusters memo, and if nobody reads it, it doesn't make any difference.
Right. More often than not, those things make it worse anyway, right?
Well, we'll leave that for another day.
Right.
But we do know it's all about the people. And it's not just about staffing. And we have struggled in our lifetime, in our professional lifetime. We now have 20 years of bad decisions on staffing the procurement workforce. So it's the right people. It's the right skill set. But really what's so important is to think about getting those people, training them, giving them the opportunity for career development, empowering them to make good decisions, and not basically cutting off their heads anytime they try to do something creative and make a mistake. So I think that it's really
that
great.
Last one is a big, that last observation. It truly is, you see it day in and day out, the risk-averse culture that has really fundamentally flipped. One thing you can say, I think, about the 90s, because I was in government, and you were too,
We
tried a lot of different things.
Right.
Threw a lot against the wall. Some of it worked, some of it didn't.
I mean, and there's a lot of retrospective criticism, but I do think that the drum that Steve Kelman was pounding, I think Jack Gansler was doing it at DOD, Colleen Preston as well. I mean, look, we could even say that to some extent Darlene Druyan was doing it, but that didn't necessarily work out so well. But truly, then I think that the late 90s were about trying to empower trusted business advisors to make good business decisions with their customers' interests at heart. And really, that's what procurement should all be about. And we've come a long way from that. Now, we've talked a lot over the years about the reality that the compliance culture, as you say, makes buyers risk averse. What we don't want as a customer is someone who is more worried about making a mistake than they are motivated to make a good business decision for the customer. And frankly, I think that's really where we are. And, you know, the rise of DCAA, the empowerment of the IGs, Congress basically sticking their finger in the eye of anybody just to have 2 seconds of media time. This is not the way we get good business decisions.
Right. And I couldn't agree with you more, the idea of making good business decisions to support the customer. And ultimately, that's the American people, right? You know, empowering people to do that. You know, and there's, you know, and I know that it's near and dear to your heart. That's why you picked principle number five to talk about first, right?
Yeah.
So what else, what other principles you want to tackle?
Okay, let's go to number six, because it's kind of interesting related. But
it comes after five, too.
Yeah, well, no, but if we were to sit down and say, and it's funny, training both law students and business students at the university and, you know, also talking to them around the world, this seems to be one of the things that is frequently lost in the training of new people, and we even see it in the ranks. So principle six basically says, incentives work, and we get what we reward. Okay. Contracting, contracts, is all about incentives. You know, we exchange our promises, and theoretically, if you understand incentives, the customer should be making clear to the contractor, this is what's most important to me, and I am willing to reward you or incentivize you for doing the things that make me happy, and more importantly, not doing the things that disappoint me or make me unhappy. Profit is an incentive. It's not the only kind of incentive, but what's amazing is how limited the government's thinking is historically and at a macro and a micro level on this area. Arguably, you could say that Better Buying Power 1.0 and even parts of 2.0 were all about ramping down or ratcheting down profit. So it was antithetical to the understanding that incentives are what really drives the process.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's still, I mean, that's still, to me, Ian, despite these principles and the stuff, at the operational level, and you see that, I think, a fair amount now, is that, you know, at the top level and the philosophical statements by leadership versus at the operational level, there's a big disconnect. It's government. It's a big disconnect.
But it's more important than that. Let's focus on the disconnect just for a second. What my students heard when this document first came out was that I love the 10 principles, but I found it impossible to correlate them with better buying power. I thought there was basically no correlation whatsoever.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And here's my favorite example. At the same time that USDA T&L was putting out this document, they were also in the midst of doing their annual review of the performance of the acquisition system. One of the biggest disclosures this year was that while DOD is excited, pleased, and happy that they've driven down prime contractor profits, they're frustrated that subcontractors seem to be making higher profit rates than prime contractors, and their goal for next year is to drive down subcontractor profits. Well, you can't tell me out of the same mouth that incentives work and we get what we reward, but we're going to beat our chest and have a parade when we drive down profit as our goal or our aspiration. You can't reconcile the two of those.
Right. Well, do you view LPTA, is that part of the thinking there? And even just cost reimbursement contracting, because it's limited.
Well, we've talked a lot about LPTA.
Yeah.
Lowest price technically acceptable is antithetical to the idea that incentivizing contractor behavior is the way that you get the best value for money and the highest customer satisfaction. So, you know, it's one of these things, you just can't have it both ways. So to be clear,
I agree,
as I think most right-thinking people do, I agree with the principle. Incentives matter.
Right, right.
Okay.
And maybe there was an incentive to focus on promoting incentives.
You
would think there would be, right?
Yeah.
Right. So, okay, we got about a minute left in this segment, and do you want to start on one? We can keep this going. This is great stuff.
Well, let's introduce the next one, and we can talk about it a little bit afterwards. Okay, let me jump to principle nine. What's really fascinating about Principle 9 is you would never know this from Better Buying Power, but what's fascinating is if you look at the release of Better Buying Power 3.0 and you find the little seen fact sheet that accompanied it, you find this buried in there. But this is the nugget that has been lost in the details and maybe the one that should really scare the crap out of you as an American.
Okay.
Principle 9. Our technological superiority is at risk, and we must respond. This fact is the reason for Better Buying Power 3.0.
And right there, we have to stop and take our break.
Can't wait to come back.
Right, a cliffhanger for our listeners. My guest today is Steve Schooner. He's a Nash and Spinnick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And you are listening to Off the Shelf, and we'll pick up on that principle number 9 when we come back from the break. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Steve Schooner. He is a Nash and Spinnick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And we're talking right now about Frank Kendall's recent article on better buying power principles and what are they. And when we took the break, we were about to talk about principle number 9, which is our technological superiority is at risk. And we must respond. And I'm going to turn it over for you. So this is
huge. So if you've been following the data, and you know, there's a lot of interesting ways you can find the data, but frankly, one of the best sources for data over the last decade has been Dave Berteau at CSIS before he went back to DOD. But CSIS has done a great job really taking the data apart. But the one thing that's become unbelievably clear since the economy got tight in about 2008 is that when the money got tight, the Department of Defense stopped spending money on research and development. And it's not just a minor thing. Across the board, the biggest hits in terms of percentages were in research and research and development. And this is about basic research, applied research, and one of the most interesting aspects of this has been independent research and development. Now, one of the reasons this is so interesting is that the early better buying power issues included DOD getting more control over independent research and development.
Yep.
I can't even get my head around that. But first of all—
Exactly. Right.
Okay. So what you can't see on the radio is we're sitting here literally banging our heads against the wall of the studio as we're having this conversation.
Right.
But first of all, it's an incredibly small number, but the overall spending— in terms of percentage of acquisition on basic research, applied research in the most important areas, the critical areas, and independent research and development is as low as it's been in our professional lifetimes. Now, look, I'm not saying this is necessarily true for the Department of Transportation, but for my Department of Defense, I want battlefield superiority. I want to have the best aircraft in the sky. I want to be able to defeat the enemy. I want the same in the sea and on the ground. And if we're not investing on maintaining our technical superiority, this gives me high degrees of anxiety. Well, the interesting thing is the principle is absolutely correct.
Yes.
But the practice is demonstrating that we are not doing what the principle requires. So I can't reconcile them at all, but I think it's absolutely true. Now, as you and I were talking a little bit before when we weren't on the air, there's a number of interesting observations on this. And I think, frankly, one of the most entertaining anecdotes on this had nothing to do with anything coming out of the better buying power, but is basically on your bookshelf or at your local bookstore, and you can probably pick it up in the airports as well. So if you haven't read it yet, McCullough, the great biographer of the modern era, if you haven't read his book about the Wright brothers, I can't recommend it enough. Great book. And as we were talking earlier, I basically just had a piece in the recent issue of Contract Management Magazine about some innovation lessons learned that we can learn from the Wright brothers. And the interesting thing about the book is there's so many things in there about the most familiar story that all of us grew up with that you just wouldn't know. I mean, you know, why was it that the Wright brothers never went to college? I mean, really kind of a fascinating story that had to do with a crazy hockey accident and literally a guy who ends up being a mass murderer. But again, sidelights aside.
You're teasing the book right there. That's good.
Yeah, the book is great, but just reading it, How is it that the most significant, one of the most significant technological innovations of the modern era took place not just without government support, but despite the government's consistent rebuttal of that support? So there's a lot of crazy things in the story, but again, a few lessons that, you know, I took away from it.
Sure.
I think that one of the interesting ones is that if you go back and read the history of aviation, you're reminded about another government initiative, which is one that the Defense Department, frankly, hasn't shown that much interest in, and that's been the resurgence of prizes and contests. So many of you know the history of the Longitude Prize, and there's a great book called Longitude that's really worth reading. But the problem of longitude, the creation of the chronometer, was solved by a massive prize a couple hundred years ago. Similarly, you know, why did Lindbergh fly across the country? He did it to win a huge prize.
Yeah.
Napoleon used prizes. There have been prizes for pretty much everything. And we've done some additional research on prizes as well. But if you haven't visited challenge.gov, www.challenge.gov, you'll be surprised by the level of activity that has been encouraged by the White House, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, OSTP, and frankly, a number of other agencies, including NASA. But DOD isn't really playing on this. But what's interesting is the big money that the Wright brothers first got was all through competitions and prizes.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And a lot of that was early Michelin money.
Non-government contracts.
Right, yeah. So the Wright brothers won the initial Michelin Prize for aviation. And there's a lot of other prizes too. But prizes have a much richer and more robust history in Europe than they do in the United States. But there is a lot of government policy on that. I think it's a double-edged sword, but it's something we need to start paying more attention to. And if you can't afford research and development, prizes are more effective for a bunch of reasons. But one of them is innovators want to win prizes and they want the recognition or the imprimatur of being the winner.
Right.
Therefore, you can frequently incentivize far greater innovation and investment in innovation by giving big, showy, gaudy awards than you can get through funding research and development contracts. So frankly, right. I think DOD needs to do more on that.
Right. Well, you know, when you're talking about this, the other thing that immediately pops to mind is the DOD opening an office in Silicon Valley.
And, sure, absolutely.
I guess maybe
absolutely.
Up in Boston too, I don't know, and, you know, along 128, whatever. But that's sort of, again, this disconnect here between, like, we want innovation. And I guess they realize they're not spending any money, so they've got to, like, go to the places that are centers of innovation and try to say, please do business with us.
Well, that's another lesson learned that, you know, we talk about in the article, and that is that DOD needs to look outside the inner circle for new ideas. One of the things that's really fascinating when you start doing research on the history of prizes and what we call paradigm-shifting innovation is that it's not the conventional sources that have the breakthrough idea. One of the great stories about the Wright brothers is the fact that they are consistently rebuffed by the United States government, including the Smithsonian, because the government is invested in a bigger, more well-known player, and they spend staggering sums of money in an option that fails dramatically.
Yeah.
And so the book talks a lot about the fact that the government-funded solution gets all the money, sucks all the air out of the room, and then fails spectacularly, while the Wright brothers literally get no support and grind their way to success.
So I have to ask you, I'm looking at, you know, this principle, our technology superiority is at risk and we must respond. And you've talked about, you know, the lack of investment, the potential use of prizes, that's an incentive. So I'm going back to incentives work. The principle six, we get what we reward. But in the government contracts context too, isn't there a disconnect between it seems to me, especially with the intellectual property rights and the balance there,
it's
completely out of balance in the sense of, yeah, we want to maintain superiority, but we want to do it in a, you know, I guess in a utopian world of full and open competition and we share things? I mean, am I off the mark there?
I think you really put your finger on the open sore when you mention intellectual property, because again, this has been a very controversial issue with regard to better buying power. I mean, if you really want private firms to innovate, then you have to either let them reap the rewards of their intellectual investments, or pay or use a different pricing structure if you want to own that. So what we see is, at the same time DOD is trying to squeeze profit margins and reduce overheads, DOD is also claiming broader rights to intellectual property. And that is objectively going to be increasingly a barrier to entry. The most innovative firms are not going to want to play with DOD if they think they're going to put their investment in innovation at risk. This is a huge, huge issue.
Yeah, and it's I think it also is reflected in the recent, you know, draft memo on software, open source from OMB in terms of, you know, pounding on the issue of, you know, if it's developed in performance of government contractor, but to that point, as a company, your crown jewels are the brains of that person writing the code or figuring out the solution or the next innovation. And there's got to be some way to capitalize on that beyond for the incentive and long term beyond just this initial contract. It just doesn't.
Well, there's actually a really good book on a related topic by Eugene Golsh, who's down at the University of Texas in the Public Policy School. And he actually spent some time in DOD working on industrial base when Ash Carter was still there. But I think one of the things that his book reminds readers that don't spend a lot of time thinking about this is that we need to think about the fundamental difference between the way the marketplace treats innovation and the way the government does.
And we got to stop there, and we can maybe pick up on that when we come back and maybe do another principle or two and move on to some other topics. My guest today is Steve Schooner. He's a National Sabbatical Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Steve Schooner. He's a National Sabbatical Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. Hey, and Steve, we took that break. You were about to provide some additional thoughts on the market versus government and the treatment of innovation and intellectual property and that sort of thing.
So I think here's the important point in understanding the difference in the way that the private sector views innovation and the way that the government does. The private sector consistently invests staggering sums of their own resources, their own money, in research and development. And as a general rule, they do it because they want to have a new idea that they can bring to market. The perfect situation is I bring my new idea to market, I'm first to market, I therefore have a short-term monopoly position, and I charge a price premium that is commensurate with my investment and my short-term monopoly position. I then take my profits from my premium pricing, and as the rest of the market catches up, I then plow my profits back into research and development on other innovations so that I can once again be first to market and charge price premiums. This is the cycle of innovation. All you have to do is watch Apple or, you know,
Google,
anyone. I come up with a new idea that I funded. I am first to market. I charge a fortune for it. I take my profits. I put them into innovating on the next great idea. So this whole idea that you can reduce profits, control intellectual property, and expect the defense industry to innovate is just somewhat surreal. And again, I really encourage you to take a look at the Wright Brothers article in last month's Contract Management magazine. I do want to mention one other thing on this. As we talk about the fact that the world is getting smaller, one of the most interesting things that we saw from the Wright Brothers experience is that innovation respects no geographical boundaries. And frankly, one of the most surprising aspects of the story was that the Wright Brothers made all of their initial money in Europe. They weren't getting any love. They weren't getting any attention from the United States government, even though they begged and pleaded to do business with them. They finally packaged everything up. They went to Europe. They were a smash success, and the money started rolling in. And only then did the United States government start paying attention. The last thing I'd mention on this is one of the most fundamental errors that we see in defense acquisition year in and year out. The Wright Brothers experience is all about prototyping. Nobody wanted to pay them until they saw the thing fly.
Right.
The history of defense acquisition is about spending staggering amounts of money on aspiration and promises rather than going through the steps of funding innovation, proven demonstration and validation, flying prototypes and the like. There's an obvious lesson to be learned here. DOD knows it as a matter of policy. They just cannot control themselves as a matter of practice.
Well, and why do you think that is?
I mean, people blame the budget cycle, but I just don't buy it. I think that it is a fundamental lack of discipline and, frankly, the fantasy of the great solution. I mean, everybody wants to change the world, but change is incremental. That's the way it works. Look, if nothing else, let me just use that as a segue into principle one.
Sure,
because
absolutely.
We're talking about Frank Kendall's principles for better buying power. Principle number one, continuous improvement will be more effective than radical change. Let me say it again. Continuous improvement will be more effective than radical change. Look, this is the way the private sector works. The automobile was invented a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Automobiles get a little bit better every single year.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Defense Department wants to buy the thing that doesn't exist, which they're going to field 5, 10, 15, or 20 years from now, instead of incremental improvement. All of the research has been done.
Right.
Basically demonstrates we need to focus more on incremental improvement rather than betting the farm on the great paradigm shifting change.
It's a thought of I want the 100% solution that, you know, for the Navy that literally can walk on water, right? As opposed to the achievable initial, you know, let's say 65% solution and building on that. What's more cost effective in the long run? They spend all, you know, the situations they spend all a lot of money, a lot of investment to try to get to the 100% place, and they can't do it. They have to build on some success first, too.
Right. And it's not only the aspiration of the 100% paradigm shifting solution, but to want it on an unrealistic schedule that's based on promises, not based on fact or research the like. And again, you know, this leads us to, now I'm back to principle number two, because, you know, I love the way Frank talks about this, and I love the fact that it's absolutely imperative that people understand it, but we don't. But principle number two is data should drive policy. And he goes on to say, outside of his door, there's a sign that says, in God we trust, all others must bring data. But what's fascinating in acquisition, and you and I have talked about this quite a bit over the years, in federal acquisition, we measure what is easy to measure, and we don't measure what's important. What are the things that we always measure? We measure how we divide the pie, small business participation rates.
Right.
Okay. That's the thing that heads of acquisition fear the most, is being brought up to Congress to be yelled at for not meeting their goals.
Yeah. And it's, you know, prime contracts, subcontracting goals, the whole.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then what else do we measure? We measure total federal spend, which is utterly irrelevant to anything. But the three metrics that we spend the most time thinking about are the three that matter the least. We ask whether the contractor delivered on time or was late, which makes no difference whatsoever if the original schedule was unrealistic.
Yes.
We measure whether the contractor came in under budget or over budget, which again is irrelevant. I'll come back to that in a second. And then we measure whether the contractor complied with the performance specifications or not. But let me suggest that in the private sector, there's really only two things that matter in procurement, and none of them are the ones we just talked about. So look in the mirror right now. If you're driving the car, pull over on the side of the road, look in the mirror and ask yourself this question. When you spend your money, what do you care about? I think you only care about two things. You care about customer satisfaction. Were you happy with your purchase? And two, you care about value for money.
Yep.
Did you get what you paid for?
Mm-hmm.
You really couldn't care less about anything else other than those things. So you can come up with all of the unrealistic constraints you want, but when you read the DOD performance assessment of the acquisition regime, what you find is all of the data focuses on the things that we find easy to measure,
right. And
we never talk about the things that matter. Okay, now look, I know you're interested in category management, and there's a lot of folks listening today that care about that. My favorite example of this is the Prices Paid portal or the Prices Paid initiative. I honestly don't care how good a price you got for something if you didn't want it or if it doesn't work or if it breaks quickly. So don't tell me about purchase price. Talk to me about life cycle cost, Okay. I'm into principle four, right?
Okay.
Kendall's got everything in here. Principle four. Controlling life cycle costs is one of our jobs. Staying on budget isn't enough. If you buy something that's inexpensive and you didn't want it or you didn't need it or it doesn't work, it's not a bargain.
No, it's a waste of money.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
I got that one. All right.
but I mean, this is so fundamental to our core understanding. As a matter of policy, DOD says it cares about life cycle cost and total cost of ownership, but we don't measure it. More importantly, what did we talk about a few minutes ago? Incentives. Do we incentivize life cycle cost or total cost of ownership?
Over time,
yeah. Or do we incentivize, you said it before, low price. Right. That's what we incentivize. It's nonsensical.
Yeah, it's fascinating too. And you do it as an individual to your point. You know, I'm thinking about the car I own, value for money, right? I'm very happy with it. And, you know, I can start to tick that. But for an institution, maybe it's easier for a person than an institution or maybe not. I don't know.
But I think that you just hit the nail on the head. It's hard. But right. Just because it's hard doesn't mean the government shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And look, the private sector does this. Hey, if you're out there listening, you ever buy a car? You ever take your car in for service? What happens after you buy your car or you take it in for service? The automobile dealer starts peppering you with surveys. We want feedback.
Yes. Yes. Please, Mr. Waldron, can you make sure you submit the survey? It helps me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Everyone in the private sector, and why do they care so much about customer satisfaction feedback? Because they want you to buy from them again.
Right, recurring revenue.
The closest thing that we've done in our lifetime was past performance. And past performance is better than nothing, but it still comes down to the contracting officer assessing the three things that don't matter. Did the contractor finish on time? Did they finish under the purchase price? Did they meet the performance spec? In other words, it's the contracting officer assessing the shopping experience. Are we asking the program manager if the thing works? Are we asking the end user if it meets their needs? This is not difficult. Okay, now, it may be expensive, and we may need to learn, but why we wouldn't think that this is one of the most important paradigm-shifting approaches we can take to management is utterly beyond me. If we really want to change the way we think about acquisition, let's focus on customer satisfaction.
You know,
value
it's the
for
flip
money.
Side, and we have to take a break. To me, it's the flip side. Like we talk. I mean, there's a strong. You know, I guess you know, you talk to folks in the industry. Understand sound requirements lead to good outcomes.
How about correlating requirements and outcomes?
Right, and the outcome. Yeah, and it's like so. There's a lot of focus. It seems to me a lot of conversation around making sure we get the requirements right. But at the end of the day, did we really get the requirements right and did the outcome? And are we really connecting the two as effectively as it can?
And I know we need to take the break, but let's also go back to the one thing that Ash Carter was told in no uncertain terms when they first rolled out Better Buying Power. The acquisition community is not going to alter the budget landscape. The requirements community.
Yes.
is the one that's actually in charge
right.
of those issues.
Absolutely. My guest today is Steve Schooner. He's a Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University's Law School. And when we come back, we'll finish up on Mr. Kendall's article, but we also got this interesting joint statement on preserving competition issued by the FTC and DOJ, preserving competition in the defense industry. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Steve Schooner. He is the Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And Steve, we got to finish up on better buying. I know it's a fascinating, it's a great article, and the principles are great. Execution.
All right. So I just want to mention principles 3 and 10 before we wrap up on this. Really, just worth focusing, and I'm so glad to hear Frank Kendall mention these. Principle number 3, critical thinking is necessary for success. Fixed rules are too constraining. In other words, if you go back to the Better Buying Power 2.0 slide, the best thing on the slide was when in doubt, think. Right?
Yes, right?
If our acquisition workforce is thinking, we're winning. And we definitely agree with that. Let me also briefly mention principle 10. Principle 10, we should have the courage to challenge bad policy. Okay, let's call it what it is. Most of the problems that we have in acquisition are not that difficult. The FAR is not the problem. But as we talked about before, risk aversion, that's a problem. Bad decisions, that's a problem. Poor leadership, that's systemic. But if we can empower people to make good business decisions, frankly, over time, I think we're going to get better business results. Let's focus on the things that matter. Customer satisfaction, value for money, we can get there.
Right, yeah. I agree 100%. There's things you can do around the margins, and there's things you can fix and reform with acquisition that would further empower people to think and make good business decisions. So, speaking of business, FTC and DOJ, they've issued a joint statement on preserving competition in the defense industry. And I wanted to get I guess it was issued April 12th, I believe.
So quite recently. Look, this is really an interesting document. So just to be clear, the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission basically have spoken about consolidation of the defense industry. And let's not lose sight of what's going on here. The Defense Department and Congress have been clear for a number of years, they're spending less money. So our peak in federal acquisition spending, we're basically talking 2008. It's been coming down since. The defense industry basically says, look, we're going to have to merge. You know, some of us, we just can't afford all the overhead. Everybody understands that. Okay. Two-page memo just came out. I just want to read a couple sentences, and then we can talk about what it really means. But this is the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission speaking. They say, when assessing proposed consolidation in the defense sector, the overriding goal of the agencies in enforcing the antitrust laws is to maintain competition going forward for products and services, blah, blah. Okay. Competition ensures the DoD has a variety of sourcing alternatives and the most innovative technology to protect American soldiers, sailors, Marines, and air crews at the lowest cost for the American taxpayer. So if we conceptually agree that the way you get the best prices and the highest quality is by having competition among defense contractors, then we get back to the fundamental question of the defense industrial base. Can we afford to have multiple competitors if the government doesn't want to pay for that excess capacity? Now, look, none of this is new, right?
Right.
We have plenty of experiences on this. Let's do nuclear submarines. We decided a generation ago that we couldn't afford to have multiple nuclear submarine manufacturers, but we also decided we were unwilling to only have one, so we have two, and Congress allocates the work between the two of them and demands 50% subcontracting. So there is, in fact, no competition, but we do at least have two sources.
Right.
We only have one manufacturer of engines or cores for nuclear submarines and aircraft carriers, because we can't afford to have to. No competition whatsoever. Only one manufacturer left. Those are business decisions made about the industrial base. But what we can't have is DOD saying, you, the private sector, must reduce your overhead.
Right.
And I want there to be competitive proposals on all of my expensive RFPs, but you can't consolidate. I mean, there's got to be a business case. It's just irrational. Formalistic competition for the sake of competition, silly.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what are we willing to pay for?
Right. Well, you know, it does, and it strikes me too when you can see it across other. You know, it's not just in the defense arena, or it's related to defense arena. You see consolidation in services,
of course.
And a lot of it's we're not going to pay. We're going to do LPTA. It's margins and you can't afford the overhead.
Right.
So there's consolidation there too, and at a certain point, and then we get back to intellectual property rights, it's all connected.
And there are certain economies of scale; some are never going to be resolved. But look, in large part, many people think this is an after-the-fact reaction to Lockheed Martin's acquisition of Sikorsky, the helicopter manufacturer. I really don't care if you think it was a good idea or a bad idea. This is the reality of a shrinking defense market. And if you're not going to permit your major metal benders to become more efficient and merge, then you're going to have to pay for excess capacity. So, I mean,
You cannot have it both ways.
Exactly.
Right,
there is an industrial policy shop in USD AT&L. So it's kind of remarkable to me how intransigent they've been on this issue.
Right. Well, at the end of the day, right? If you have it both ways, you'll end up in the place you'd want to be in to begin with. Like, at least if you make a conscious decision to maintain an industrial base that has two suppliers, you have to pay for it, to your point,
right?
If you say we want this formalistic view of competition and we're not going to allow you to consolidate, you're not going to get the competition you want anyway, because you're going to have two sickly companies trying to compete who aren't healthy to be able to provide.
But look at the big procurements we've seen for the last few years. For the in-flight refueling tanker, we decided one massive generational contract with a single firm.
Yes.
The Joint Strike Fighter is all about eliminating the number of flying platforms for multiple services.
Standardization.
So if you want a single source, your primary tool, you can't expect the other contractors to be holding capacity around for the next competition in 20 years, 30 years.
Yep.
Somebody's got to pay for all this stuff.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So where does this go from here?
I think that it all cycles back to the thing that's been lost in the discussion of reducing profits and increasing efficiency in acquisition, which is ultimately, if you want innovation, you basically have to, what do they say, let 1,000 flowers bloom? It's bread on the water. You got to throw money out there and understand that a lot of things that you invest in aren't going to pan out.
Right.
Creativity is not about perfect investments expecting what's going to work in the future. You're constantly trying things, putting money into great ideas that may or may not pan out. And if we attempt to limit the overhead of the private sector and don't invest in innovation, we're going to end up getting exactly what we pay for, which is, limited creativity and unimpressive results.
Right. Well, if we're not going to reward anything, it's like principle number 6 from Mr. Kendall's memo. Incentives work. We get what we reward.
Exactly.
Right. Steve, it's been great to have you on the show, and I do expect you to, I know you'll be at the golf tournament this summer.
Looking forward to it. We've loved the golf tournament. Yeah. And again, I just want to be really clear. The George Washington University really appreciates the support of the Coalition for Government Procurement and all the folks that turn up at the golf tournament. We really love the fact that it's supporting veterans who are interested in a career in government acquisition, because we think it's a great transition. Folks with the background, the energy, and an interest in what they're supporting with the stuff they're buying, they make really good acquisition professionals.
Right. And we're honored to be able to support an endowed fellowship for a veteran studying government procurement. And our golf tournament is the chief driver raising the funding for that. And we really appreciate the partnership as well.
Well, let's hope we have great weather again this year.
Absolutely. Knock on wood. I want to thank my guest today, Steve Schooner. He is a National Sabbatical Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.